Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Ambry Next and Now podcast. My name is Christian Gund, and I'm one of the reporting genetic counselors in the Clinical Genomics Department here at Ambry. One thing we've heard from some of our clients is that they're interested in ordering an exome for one of their patients, but they've never managed a case like that before. If they had seen a case or could hear from someone who had dealt with it in the past, they would feel more confident tackling that first case themselves. So today, we've brought in someone who has experience with these types of cases. Megan Tucker, a genetic counselor with the Peyton Manning Children's Hospital at St. Vincent, and also the program director at Indiana State University. How are you today, Megan?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thank you for being with us. So, Megan, how many exome cases have you been involved with?
I would say at this point, I have probably been involved in at least close to 50 cases. When whole exome first came out as a testing option a few years ago, our clinician decided that we probably should try and reach out to any family we thought this might be beneficial for. And so we sent letters to over 50 families kind of right off the bat and, you know, pretty quickly got up to doing 10, 20, 30 cases within the first, you know, a few months to a year of it really being available. So we've done it quite frequently.
Very cool. And so you said you were able to identify a group of families you felt were good candidates. What were some of the things you were looking for that you felt made people good candidates?
Initially, we only used it for families where the child, mainly because we're mostly a pediatric clinic, but the child in front of us had multiple abnormalities, typically in multiple organ systems, and we'd already done basic testing, typically an array, maybe a karyotype, and then probably some level of sequencing. You know, maybe it was a small panel or a few individual genes, and everything had been coming back normal. The family was interested in continuing to seek out what opportunities there were for further diagnosis, and those were the families that we sought. In particular, we sought out things like Vater sequence and stuff like that to try and find answers for those families. We've broadened that a little bit. That was just sort of our initial pool in the beginning. So now we're using it maybe not always multiple abnormalities, but things that we've done that first line testing and haven't found anything, you know, even things that look very non-specific, you know, maybe a child that has seizures and autism, you know, and a cleft or something like that. We typically want multiple findings. And even in some cases, families of kids that maybe were just slightly dysmorphic but had multiple family members with autism, particularly sets of siblings. We've been using that as a criteria as well if we've done some of these early panels and things that have all been normal. So we've broadened who we offer it to at this point.
Interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, one of the big things is you've seen these multiple abnormalities and they've been through the first line of testing, whereas exome is sort of looking for less obvious or non-standard presentations of diseases we've seen more often. So you're sort of expanding the search at that point.
Yep. And particularly that was because, you know, we were seeing success with whole exome. And so we were finding things in families, and that's what's made us kind of continue doing it and broaden who we offer it to.
Okay, so you've looked at a case and decided it's a good candidate for exome sequencing. What are some of the steps you take next? I know we ask for things like clinical records, and we're always looking for a trio here at Ambry. How do you go about gathering and determining those?
Yeah, the first thing, once we've decided that a particular patient would be a good candidate, of course, we're going to approach it with the family and see if they're interested with some just very basic information. And then we're going to seek out that insurance coverage first, because if I can't perform the testing, then I don't feel the need to go seeking out everything else. So we'll start with that insurance coverage piece. Once we do get that approval, then we'll go back to that family for a more thorough consent process, figure out how do we obtain the trio. Occasionally, we have had to send cases where it's proband only because the trio is not available or something like that. We always have some degree of records because these are families we've already seen, we've already done testing. So I usually have enough records to at least assess the insurance coverage. But once it's approved, then we'll work on obtaining more of those medical records to really get the full depth of the clinical presentation to help with the interpretation for the laboratories.
And that makes sense. It's definitely a big help when we get very complete and thorough records for our interpretations, but it doesn't make sense for you to go gathering up all of that before you're sure whether or not you can get the test covered. How have you found the insurance coverage has been? Have you found it's been good or getting better lately? I know a lot of papers have been coming out emphasizing the cost effectiveness of exome or other benefits. Have you found those helpful?
We have. It seems a little hit or miss. I have not been able to have too much experience with some of the newer codes that have come out within the last year for whole exome. So I'm more familiar with kind of the older codes that were being used as of last year. And we were having a good number of private insurance companies that were willing to cover testing. Unfortunately, sometimes the out-of-pocket cost was high for families. Insurance companies such as Medicaid and whatnot, you know, universally not covering the testing. So unfortunately, we do have to sort of limit it to those families who have private insurance. And then it seems to be a little bit hit or miss, but we're getting relatively good coverage.
Okay. And so you've looked at that. You've got the insurance clearance. You've got the records together. And now it's time to present these options to the family themselves. And I know a big concern for a lot of counselors is the consenting process. And how do you make sure they're giving an informed consent? So how does the consenting process usually go?
It's almost, I guess, on our side, they kind of have a little bit of a two-part consent. So we're going to give them the first kind of brief introduction before we go through with the whole insurance approval and whatnot. And basically, that's, in my mind, going to consist of letting them know, hey, we think there's some additional testing that may be beneficial for your family, kind of reminding them what we've maybe already done. So we've done smaller panels that included only a few genes. And this testing is an option to now try and spell out what I always refer to as the functional portions of all 20,000 genes. I'm also going to make sure to give them up front that it is a relatively slow and expensive process, and it's not guaranteed to give them an answer, but it is sort of our next step to keep digging. At that point, I always want to make sure to let them know, for some families, we find something straightforward and clear. Some families, we don't find anything. And some families, we find something that there's some uncertainty to, or there's, where we're not quite sure what it means, and kind of making sure they have an idea of what those results may look like in a very broad sense. I always want to emphasize to them that just because I find an answer does not always mean that I'm going to find a treatment. This may only give me an explanation. It may not give me how to deal with it. On the other hand, sometimes it can. And so we always want to at least give them those kinds of ideas and then let them know that, we are going to assess the insurance coverage and have that kind of information verified before we proceed with testing. Once it's approved, that's at least given them some basic information. A lot of times we may give them an information sheet that we've created just kind of with some of those points in writing for them to take with them. Once it's approved, then we're going to sit down a little bit more thoroughly. Sometimes it's in person. Many a times it's over the phone, which can be a challenge for sure. But I'll reiterate those things that we've already discussed, kind of explain, that an exon is sort of that functional portion of a gene. There are areas in between the exons that are not going to be evaluated with this testing. So I don't want them to get the impression that I am literally spelling out everything, but it's looking at the vast majority of places where I'm expected to find something. And I always want to make sure to let them know that, everyone has hundreds of variants. That's what makes us all unique. But it's the lab's responsibility a lot of times to filter those out. And I'm looking at 20,000 genes, so they're usually pretty realistic as to why it takes so long for us to be able to get results back when they acknowledge the depth of this testing. And so I'll let them know at that point, what we're looking at or why the clinical information is so important is to be able to help the labs filter out what's completely irrelevant, which changes in the genes, because it's normal to have them, but which ones are actually disrupting how a gene functions and leading to problems, and that there are changes that really we don't think do much of anything, or maybe we don't really know a whole lot, and we don't always get those kinds of things reported back to us. So we're trying to filter out to those things that are relevant.
So you find that really giving them a sense of the scale of the test, that we're looking at so many alterations and looking through the noise to find what is hopefully the signal for them, really gives them some level of understanding.
I do, and I find it helpful, particularly because I kind of want to prep them for the fact that we don't know everything. And, you know, I might not get a clear result. I might get one, but there's a lot of unknown. And so I kind of want them to at least realize what this involves so that when those results come back, I can kind of use that in, you know, the counseling piece. And we will, of course, make sure to cover those things like, because of the depth of this testing, I have the potential to identify things that I'm not looking for. You know, things like paternity or, you know, relations within a family. Those aren't things I'm looking for. In all honesty, in the clinical setting, I have yet to come across any problems with that or any, you know, glaring surprises, but I'm at least going to mention that. I rarely get too many questions once in a while, but they usually understand at least that, hey, this is something that has the potential to identify that kind of thing. And then, of course, it's those secondary findings that raise a lot of red flags for counselors, I think, on how do we tackle those. So that's a big piece of that informed consent as well, and just let them know that, you know, there are a group of disorders that are unrelated, but our professional organizations have decided that families, you know, have the right to know about those if they want to. And I'll kind of tell them a little bit about, you know, these tend to be cancer predispositions or cardiac complications or maybe reactions to anesthesia. They may be adult onset or something like that, but these aren't unclear findings. This would be if your child has something that's a clear misspelling that's disrupting the gene and there's something that we would change about their medical management and kind of let them know that these secondary findings are an option for them if they want to know that kind of information. We're happy to be able to share that with them. If they don't want to know that, it doesn't hinder what I'm trying to find, which is the reason why their child has, you know, the multiple abnormalities that we're trying to assess. And that doesn't hinder what I'm looking for. And families seem to understand that pretty well. You know, I don't tend to have a lot of major problems there. Most of them seem very receptive to receiving that information. But I always want to make sure to tell them two other aspects, which is that this isn't going to identify common disorders like diabetes, just because there are too many genes and too many lifestyle factors and not enough known about what the genetics side can do for us from a treatment perspective. And at the same time, it's not going to reveal adult onset non-treatable disorders, things like Alzheimer's or something like that. And usually knowing that helps bring them a lot of comfort that, hey, these are things that may be worthwhile that aren't going to just cause unnecessary anxiety.
It lets them feel that, these really are things that they would want to know about.
Most families seem to. We get the few that say, you know what, I don't want to know that kind of thing, but most seem to be very willing to learn that. You know, these families are seeking out, what can I do differently? How can I treat this child? And they want to know if there's something that's maybe unrelated to why their child is in front of us, but something that they could do to help them even down the road.
And of course, we offer everyone the opportunity to opt out of these secondary findings if they choose to do so, but you did talk a little bit about the possibility of an uncertain result. I know variants of uncertain significance are always a big concern for counselors reporting these results out to patients. Have you found that patients are dealing with that uncertainty well, or are they comfortable with that uncertainty going in?
I think they're comfortable with the possibility of uncertainty going in, but they're not always as comfortable when it's the result they get. So, you know, they think they understand it. And then when we get a result back and it's unclear, you know, they always want to know, well, why? How could it be unclear? We did this, you know, huge amount of testing and where do I go from here? So they do have, some families seem to adjust very well to the uncertainty and are very comfortable with the fact that, hey, this is a growing field and we're learning more all the time. And they're very comfortable with the fact that things just aren't clear. And some families, you know, just really that's frustrating for them. So I'm not sure they fully get it. And even if I've, in some families, I've really in the beginning spent a little bit more time on that. And it didn't seem to drastically change their reaction afterwards. So I always make sure to discuss it, but I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time, mainly because I don't know what that result's going to show. It may be normal and it may be clearly abnormal. And we could spend, you know, an hour just discussing the variants before I even do testing. So we just kind of had to deal with it.
Now, one thing I know has come up a bit for exome and often comes up in other aspects of genetic testing is insurance discrimination. Now, we have laws in place to prevent insurance discrimination in certain types of insurance. For instance, a big example is life insurance, especially for patients that are non-symptomatic at time of testing. But do you discuss that? I mean, how do you deal with questions about how will this affect my future insurance? Or do you find that's just not something patients are very concerned with at the time?
I find it that most of them aren't concerned about it at the time, particularly because it's their, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5-year-old child that we're evaluating, and they don't have a good perspective for, you know, necessarily what does that mean for them in 20 years. These also tend to be kids that are pretty significantly affected with some kind of a disorder. So the likelihood they're seeking out, you know, independent private insurance that's not through government type policies or group insurance through an employer, you know, is relatively small, but not zero. So for those that say, yes, I want to know those secondary findings, it's something that I always want to make sure to at least mention that, you know, these are things the child's not symptomatic for. And if they have concerns about what that means for them down the road, you know, then if they express those concerns, then I'm more than happy to kind of explain a little bit about how there are protections in place for some aspects, but other things, like you had said, the life insurance and whatnot, you know, those protections just aren't currently there. And that may be something they would want to at least sort of think about. So it kind of depends on their reaction to at least mentioning the possibility, how much in depth we might get into that.
Okay. Another thing at Ambry is that we're always looking to get the proper trios. And typically those are parent-child. But we're also interested in relevant relatives for COSEG. How have you found the process of gathering these samples and organizing the trio? I mean, you're not just testing a proband sample in this case.
Most of the time, we've had pretty good luck. If the parents are alive and involved in the child's life, the vast majority of the time, they seem very willing to at least contribute a blood sample. And all the labs that we use, you know, provide kits. So frequently, I may be mailing them. I've mailed them to Colorado. I've mailed them to, you know, all kinds of places to get those samples collected. So that's typically how we have to deal with those if it's not a local case. Most tend to be willing. Now, of course, we get some where they're not, or we get some where one parent, you know, has passed away. And I'll, at that point, definitely offer them, you know, a second sibling or another family member. They don't seem to be as willing to reach out beyond that parent-child little cohort to seek those things out for other relatives. And most of them don't seem to be willing to have another sibling have a blood draw if it's another child, just to kind of help interpret. So if both parents aren't available, it's unlikely that in our case that I've been successful in getting another relative to complete some kind of a trio. And at that point, we'll usually send maybe one parent in the proband. But most of our cases, I've been able to send all three.
All right. And is there anything else in that first session that you think is very important or maybe somewhat specific to exome that we haven't covered?
Not in the just sort of organizing the testing itself and moving forward from that perspective.
Yeah, okay. So I think the next thing is talking about returning the results to the patient. So how have you found the patients have been receiving results? I mean, presumably they're happier to get positive results than negative results. But have you found that, say, the positives that are positives, but maybe there's some ambiguity there? Do the patients seem to understand that, or do they really seem to latch on to that positive?
You're absolutely right. They seem much more pleased when I have a positive result that explains something than when it's negative. They're always very disappointed when it's a negative result and we just didn't find an answer for their family that clearly is having concerns in front of them. It's rare that they're relieved that the testing was normal. So they usually at that point are saying, well, now what? What else do we do? When it's a positive result, you know, there's definitely that spectrum of response. I've had some where it's a clear mutation and they still are, you know, just so surprised that we found something that they, you know, may not handle it well. Of course, that's a possibility on even just a small panel. The variants do tend to be a bigger challenge, of course. And we do get plenty of them that come back with a variant. And those can be difficult for those families because they definitely want to latch on to that. Our clinician honestly likes to latch on to that as well, to a degree, to say, you know what, we may not understand it fully, but this may be contributing to what's going on here, and we just need to learn more. So we know that that's something we'll at least address, that that's a possibility. Now, if I get a variant that's predicted, you know, benign by all of our predictor models, that's a different story. But if it's a variant of unclear significance and, you know, all of my predictor models suggest that it's pathogenic and the clinical features fit very well, we tend to lean on that as probably a contributing factor that we just don't fully understand. So that's something that may be a little different than some clinics because that's just the preference of the provider that I work with. So that's something that makes things a little different, I would say. But we're definitely going to rely on some of the research that we do. And the families seem very receptive to the fact that we don't know everything. And we've done as much digging as possible. And, you know, as long as in that session I'm really sharing with them, we will tell them that, you know what, we used 3 predictor models and 2 out of the 3 said it's likely disrupting a protein and 1 said it didn't. And here are the cases in the literature regarding this gene and, you know, the spectrum that we see, and here's why the child fits that syndrome and here's why the child doesn't fit that syndrome. They seem to do okay with that, and acknowledging that this isn't black and white. There's a lot of subtleties. There's a lot of other factors at hand as well.
That's good. And in those cases where you have one of those uncertains and we're not quite sure yet, do you discuss reanalysis? I mean, here at Ambry, we offer 1 free reanalysis within 2 years, and also a reanalysis should any new symptoms start to appear. There is some sort of utility for them to just have that data to be looked at again in the future. Do you discuss that with them?
Oh, absolutely. Any of our cases that there was a variant of unclear significance and something that just didn't give me a clear, straightforward explanation, I'm going to let the family know at that counseling session that we will offer a reanalysis to them to take a second look, because we've actually already had 2 so far that upon reanalysis, we've found something that explained it or was straightforward or clarified things. So anytime it's unclear, I'm always going to tell the families, this is something that we are going to do because we know we're learning as this goes. And I'll give them that time frame. You know, some places it's 1 year, some places it's 2. I'll usually tell them, I'm going to put a note down for us to request this for you, but you may follow up with us in 1 or 2, depending on where it went, to, you know, prompt us for that, because we want to make sure we're continuing to make sure we're finding new information if possible.
All right. Well, I've got a couple final questions here, but before we launch into those, anything else about the process that you feel is important to share or that you'd like to mention?
The only other thing I want to mention is, you know, people do get pretty freaked out about the incidental secondary findings. And, you know, I know in the literature, it's always reported as a relatively low likelihood that you're going to find something. And, you know, we do truly see that in at least our clinical perspective. You know, we've really only found a secondary or an incidental finding in less than a handful of cases. So it is something that really does not come up very often. And when it has come up, all of our families have seemed very appreciative of knowing that, hey, this is something we need to pay attention to for the future. So that's something that I know can cause some anxiety for counselors as well. And it seems to be very manageable.
All right. So like I said, just a few final questions. I know you've shared a couple of the ways you explain things to people. Do you have any other favorite analogies or allusions that you can use to explain concepts to patients?
Yeah, I don't think my analogies probably aren't anything, you know, terribly more creative than anybody else's. But, you know, I always have that standard visual aid that explains chromosomes more like a book style, you know, books on a bookshelf, and the genes are more like the sentences on the pages, and the DNA are like those individual letters. And I always have my little standard sentences, the color of the car is red, and I can have various misspellings in that sentence that may affect how you interpret it. And so I will walk through them and say, I can have some misspellings that really don't do anything. These misspellings would be like the variations that we see in our DNA. So I could spell the word color, C-O-L-O-R, or I could put a U in it. You would recognize that word. I would recognize that word. The sentence would still make sense. If that's DNA, that would be a variant that wouldn't even get reported to us because it just is the normal kind of thing that we see all the time. Those are the kinds of things that have been filtered out. I can get variants or changes in the sentence that give us something that's unclear. The color of the car was red is my example in that case. And I'll say, you know, it may still be red, so it may not have changed anything, but now maybe it's a different color and there's some kind of a gray zone uncertainty there. So that's kind of where I'll use my, variance piece. And then my third one, of course, is there can be a misspelling that says the color of the car is bed. It's only one letter, but it was enough that the sentence really doesn't make any sense. If this was a DNA and making some kind of a protein, you know, that protein is just not going to function and we're going to expect to see problems. And so that's kind of how I'll, before I even get into their results, kind of give them the categories and then say, you know, your child's result fell into this category and here's what we know about it, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'll kind of go from there.
Right. So tying those standard ways we explain these different types of mutations with what's actually happening with this specific test.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Could you share an exome success story with us?
Yeah. I mean, we've definitely had a few of them. One of them was a girl who came with pretty nondescript features. I mean, she was 6, seizures, developmental delays. We had done various testing arrays and, you know, CDKL5 and seizure panels and really hadn't found anything. And they were very adamant on trying to understand why, because her seizures were so poorly controlled. So we ended up doing whole exome sequencing. There were a couple of variants identified. One was in an SCN2A, which we were a little excited at first because we thought, oh, here's a gene that, you know, it plays a role in seizure development. But of course, it was inherited from her father, who did not have any seizures himself. So the question became, you know, do we have an incident of reduced penetrance going on? Is this not it at all? Technically, it was a variant. So it was one that just really didn't give us what we felt like was a very comfortable answer. This actually was my first case where there was an incidental finding as well. She ended up having a Lynch syndrome mutation that she inherited from her mother. And really the only family history of cancer was that her grandmother had had breast cancer and there may have been somebody else with colon cancer, but they really weren't sure who and how far back. So that was kind of an incidental finding that, you know, they were appreciative of hearing. But this was one of the ones that we ended up getting a reanalysis on, and she ended up having a de novo KCNT1 mutation that clearly seemed to fit her symptoms very well, and there had been a couple of case reports that had come out in the meantime of successful treatment of the seizures with vagal nerve stimulators. And so, you know, we got a hold of the neurologist and said, hey, is this something that you've considered? And they had talked about it, but, you know, really hadn't gone forward with it yet. And this was something that then kind of prompted them to say, okay, yes, now let's consider this as a treatment option and kind of go from there. So that one was one of our first exomes that we had ordered and I felt like was a very worthwhile success story. The other one was a 5-year-old boy, who came, we were thinking more of a mitochondrial type phenotype. He had hearing loss. He had some kidney problems, hypokalemic and things like that. And he had seizures and developmental delays. And we just weren't quite sure, you know, what to make of all of it. And he ended up having in long QT, was his cardiac problems that went along with it as well. And initial testing didn't find anything. Well, it turns out he actually has a long QT mutation, an ANK2, but he also had a KCNJ10, which is East syndrome. So he was one of our kids that had two completely different genetic changes that we might not have identified had we not done something as expansive as whole exome, because we assumed that these were linked in some way or there was something, you know, A syndrome causing all of his features. And here his epilepsy and his hearing loss and his kidney problems were due to East syndrome, but his long QT was a completely separate, you know, genetic mutation. So that was a very helpful one as well to truly clarify his diagnosis.
Yeah, and that's definitely something we found. I mean, it's a very reasonable assumption to make that all of the symptoms are related. I mean, in most cases, those very big syndromes do have just one cause. But we're finding that in a not insignificant portion of the patients, they happen to have two identifiable mutations that are coming together to create a much more interesting phenotype that becomes much more obvious when you can separate them out.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's not our first that's had two separate causes that explain the, you know, whole spectrum of phenotypes. So even among our small group to look at, you know, that's not the first time we've had other kids the same kind of way.
All right. And any final words of advice for our listeners who are considering starting exome sequencing?
You know, not necessarily. I mean, I do. We find it to be very valuable. You know, and even if I don't find an answer for those families that are just desperate to seek it out, you know, I at least feel like we've kind of tried everything we have right now. But we've had some really good success in finding answers for those families. And it's something that I think is only going to improve with time. I really wish some of those first ones we'd ordered, you know, 3 years ago that we've kind of surpassed some of those windows of reanalysis I could look at again, just because we know things are changing so rapidly. But I definitely find it to be a very valuable test for those that are unclear. You know, if someone has very limited clinical findings, it may not be the most valuable. But for those that really have something that you're really suspicious of, I think it's a great option.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Megan, and for sharing your expertise with us. My name is Christian Gund. I'm one of the genetic counselors here at Ambry. If you'd like more information on Exome Next or any of our other offerings at Ambry, you can check out our website at www.ambrygen.com. And unless you have anything further to add, Megan, we'll end the interview here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for your time.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.